Thanks for listening to the Get Over Yourself podcast, brought to you by Carol Fit Stationary Bike Program, 8-minute workouts to get super fit. Perfect Keto, the cleanest, highest potency ketone supplements. MOFO, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. Let's get checked at home testing kits. Try LGC.com. Almost Heaven, beautiful compact home use sauna kits. Brad's macadamia masterpiece, the mind-blowing nut butter blend. And check out bradkearns.com/shop, my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance. And here we go with the show.
See, you can see stress and trauma beneath the skin. You can see how the muscles are held, how somebody holds themselves. When they're really unwell, you can see it. Somebody who is driven and perhaps distraught with their level of drive, and they're in disarray, that affects the people next to them. Brain loves what it knows, and it will keep going because it bloody loves what it knows. So be curious, and you kind of trick the brain then, go, oh yeah, it's okay. So I noticed that I swear at myself when I drop something in the kitchen. All you've done is drop something in the kitchen, and we all do that. So why am I demeaning myself, calling myself names about a simple little
Hey, listeners, get ready for a very interesting show with a British psychotherapist, burnout and trauma recovery specialist named Anna Pinkerton. And she found me from all the way over across the pond and wanted to talk about workplace burnout, which is her specialty, working with corporations. I'm like, okay, sure. And that's an interesting topic. But this show really progressed to get into some deep insights and getting to the bottom of something that she calls inner brutality. That is the negative self-image, negative self-destructive thoughts that we all harbor. Witness the insights that I provided from Dr. Bruce Lipton's book, Biology of Belief, that we're operating 93 to 98% of the time from the subconscious, and this flawed subconscious programming that we get in childhood manifests every single day in how we treat ourselves and how we think about the world and engage in self-destructive patterns and dysfunctional relationships. So you are going to love this show and some of her insights that really provided a new perspective on topics that I've never heard quite described really nicely. The starting point, and these are my excited notes that I took during the show, so this is what you're going to get into. The starting point, if you're trying to achieve personal growth, transformation, is to separate yourself as a person away from the lessons that you're trying to learn or the issues that you're facing. So you're looking for reasons rather than blame. And of course, this applies to the workplace environment. It also applies to relationships or personal growth, personal work that you're doing on yourself. As soon as there's blame, there becomes shame. And that's when you shut down and you're not self-aware and you're not able to progress and transform. So you have to work on self-awareness before you even take a crack at lifestyle transformation. And you can see I was questioning her with, how does someone sleep better and eat better so they won't be so burnt out at work? And she's backed us up a few steps. And once you get that self-awareness, then you can observe without judgment, as so many great spiritual leaders ask you to be the silent observer of your thoughts throughout the day. So the show progresses with more insights along these lines. And then she coughs up this wonderful term, inner brutality. And in her 25 years of work as a therapist, she cites this stat that 92.7% of her clients represent some form of inner brutality, these negative self-thoughts and self-beliefs that are manifested in day-to-day life. And we paint some extreme examples, but I also wanted to point out, and I reference my own personal example, is I'm not inclined to call myself an idiot and curse out loud if I can't remember where I put my keys. So I congratulate myself for that. But I also have to acknowledge that underneath the surface are these self-limiting beliefs and judgments and behavior patterns that I might not be aware of very well, because obviously they're subconscious, but they're affecting my day-to-day behaviors. And a possible reason for being stuck in dysfunctional behavior patterns or non-rewarding behavior patterns of beliefs that are just lurking beneath the surface. They're not as overt as someone who's cursing themselves all day long and calling themselves an idiot out loud or under their breath. So get ready, because we are going to learn how to build companionability to self. Here we go with Anna Pinkerton. Learn more and take the burnout quiz at annapinkerton.com. Enjoy. Welcome to the podcast. You just told me something very interesting. So I hit the record button and I'm kind of surprised to hear that you're working with a kind of a crisis here of people feeling fried from the incredible pleasure of working at home, which I can't imagine anything but tell us what the circumstances are as we talk here amidst the pandemic and the quarantine. But you're a workplace burnout expert, and you're very busy these days.
I certainly am, and I can't remember the last time I was this busy, quite frankly. And I'm working with individuals outside of companies. They might have just found me, maybe on LinkedIn or something. But a big tranche of my work is working inside companies where they know that there's an issue, but they can't quite put their finger on what it is. And it looks like for many, there's such a high anxiety because of the pandemic, but also what these companies came into the pandemic already with. So a bit like if you've got an individual that already had some kind of adversity, stress or trauma, and then COVID-19 hit, you're already under-resourced. So this idea of like working from home and not having to do the commute anymore, and it's been eclipsed by the fact that there's this enormous thing that's causing so much anxiety in people. And perhaps the natural inclination when somebody's just really anxious is, how can I put this on somebody else? Or how can I get that person to work harder in order to relieve myself of this anxiety? So that's what we're seeing a lot of, is that it's almost like a hot potato. I'm really stressed. Can you hold it for a moment, or create or provide me something that will help stabilize my own anxiety? Whether that be a report, some statistics, it's like so intense. So these people are working at home with children at home often as well, but the workload hasn't lessened for lots of people. It's got worse. And we know that that's the biggest component, not the only thing, but the biggest component to burnout is workload.
I wonder if the workload is in many cases self-imposed or a function of poor time management or poor leadership that's dumping all this work on you, because, there's a lot of interviews and podcast content about how, if you don't take a nap, your productivity falls the rest of the afternoon, or if you aren't taking care of yourself, or if you're, switching between too many different windows and multitasking, all these things lower productivity, which would equate to a higher workload, but it's not literally a higher workload. It's just you're not managing and not producing at your maximum capacity.
Well, I suppose there's that going to be that confluence of those two things. So you've got somebody's own work ethic and their individual self-care or lack of it coming to meet the reality of workload. And, I'm not sure whether it would be poor leadership, but it certainly is anxiety-led leadership and traumatized leadership. So then you've got a contaminant or a contagion, much like the virus, that is so so toxic, so overwhelming, that the person that receives those orders or receives that traumatized leadership can't help but kind of panic and pedal and mobilize to deal with it. So it's not that they're not managing their time, it's that they can't. because it's just, it's overwhelming. A bit like when the pandemic hit, we now are more used to being able to talk about it, what the restrictions mean. But when it first hit, it was so big. I don't know if you felt it, but it was just like, how can something be so big that everything in life will be changed for a while? Like, it was just, it eclipsed everything. And I think that's what's happening. So it's not that people are being shoddy with their management of it. It's just that who would have known that something so big would have come along? So I don't know. I think there's been some really interesting parallels around contagion. You know, you've got this virus that's highly contagious, incredibly dangerous, and then you've got this anxiety pandemic.
So you're saying in the workplace, these kind of dynamics might even predate the big virus pandemic. In other words,
they're absolutely.
In the corporation just because they want to make their profit goals, and the panic comes from within.
Well, for sure, what they came into the pandemic with historically is definitely going to have an impact on how resourced they are to deal with now, or certainly to have dealt with the last 3 to 4 months. So that's how I see it. I see it like you're under-resourced, or you already have multiple external stresses, and now you're faced this new stress that's so big, we don't know how to handle it. And of course, we've got that is now compounded by how long it's gone on for. So the indicators of how we come through stress is how acute the stress is and for how long it lasts. So you've got it kind of on both axes in this sense. So I think people are struggling, you know, they're starting to bow under the weight of the time.
And you're working with typically with the organization's leaders or leadership team. And so I guess when you come in there, how do you detect what the level of anxiety is, or can you ask leading questions to search for areas where they might be struggling and in need of some adjustment or some counseling?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, I've got a trauma radar. That's my specialty, right? So I'm 27 years in, so I've done thousands of hours of this. And I just can feel it, so I get a sense of it. I mean, you can see stress and trauma beneath the skin. You can see how the muscles are held, how somebody holds themselves. It's when they're really unwell, you can see it. And the other thing is that you tend to get a theme. So there's, you know, the trauma has themes about it. So if you're talking to a leadership team and there's several people saying the same thing, or they look the same, you get a sense that, okay, but it is a bit like a detective work, really. Like, how do you put this puzzle together? But it's usually fairly obvious. And of course, in a way, it's self-determining, because they've got me in as a trauma specialist to help them with the stuff that's tricky to see and tricky to talk about usually. So I get to do those bits.
One thing that occurs to me is that if some company is game enough to hire you to come in and have that level of openness and self-reflection, it seems that they might even be in the healthier category from a company who thinks everything's fine and bypasses right past the opportunity to bring in an expert.
Yes, and at some level you're right. I absolutely believe that. But trauma is so pervasive that they are some way there. But what I'm finding is that the people that are coming forward generally have a sense that there's something pretty massive going down. So, and again, that makes me have so much respect for them to take that, because they could easily just put it behind the blinkers some more and let it wreak its havoc. And the companies that come to somebody like me are saying, oh, you know, this is tricky stuff, it's really challenging, but we're not going to turn away from it. and because it will wreak the havoc. Usually, somewhat the problem has already got kind of into the dynamic already, and my job is to assess what that is, and then how do we kind of how do we unpick it and then rebuild it in a way that's strong, even when people are somewhat under-resourced. So it is challenging. But you're right. You're so right. You know, for somebody to pick up the phone or send me an email, that's a big deal. You know, they're like, oh, crikey. You know, it's bad enough what we can see, but let alone what we can't see. So I'm very careful. I hope I'm tactful as to how I feedback what I'm finding, for sure.
Well, when that time comes and you're very careful and tactful, it's still going to be probably a difficult conversation. And I'm wondering how that looks when you do your discovery work, your detective work, and then you have something to lay back on them. And I guess some suggestions too about how to change the culture. What does that look like?
What that looks like is, I'm a big believer, even when I'm working with an individual leader of an organization or a leading role with people, is that I tend to help them separate themselves as people away from the problem. So, and that's a really useful post-trauma treatment in any case. So I do that, but on a grand scale in an organization. So look, this isn't about the individual. This is somebody who is now traumatized in your organization, and they happen to behave in this way because this is how trauma plays out. So I give the feedback in a way that it doesn't point finger. It looks for reasons and not blame. Because as soon as blame is there, it's shame. And then that's the thing that gets in the way. So I say, look, it's about reasons. So that if we find the reasons for this, then we can start to unpick it and rebuild it in the way that you want it to be built for sustainability. And like you're saying, for culture change, for the future. So generally, that's how it's received in a positive manner, or certainly in a way that can be palatable and therefore useful and of value for them in the future. Because, you know, I'm going to leave the organization. I do the troubleshooting. I go, right, here's what's going down. Here's how we can fix it. Bye-bye. And that's what you want. You want to create so much value that it makes a change forever for them. And it's the same with an individual. You know, if you blame, you shame, nothing gets done. So that's really how it is. I just go, right, this is how trauma plays out. This is what's going on, and this is the process to the better culture, the better understanding, and to be able to sustain themselves.
Yeah, that little story seems to apply to anything, whether it's your individual. You're an expert in PTSD, also. You work in that realm, and it just occurs to me, whether it's a relationship, a family situation, or a giant corporation, separating yourselves as a person from the problem and staying away from blame. Because as soon as there's blame, there's shame. That's great. Put that to yourself, put that to your partnership, put that to your job. Wow.
Exactly.
Love it.
Exactly. And so in that sense, it's not really that fancy. It's you know, it can be challenging. But you just apply that same principle, and I apply that also, right, in my own life. And because there's nothing quite like being able to help somebody understand what's happening to them, and then be able to say to them, "Oh, why? This isn't about you as a person, right? This is about your wiring. This is about your trauma template. This has been wired in." So this isn't about you, this lovely person over here that's not aching and suffering or angry and out of control. There's this other person. This is the real you. And then there's this defense because you've got trauma or you've got overwhelming stress. Okay, so people generally don't come to me and say, I've got trauma or I'm traumatized, even though that is the truth. They tend to say, I'm stressed beyond belief and my head's going to blow off or something, you know. Yeah, but that is a gift to people to go, oh, it's not me. Oh, right, okay. Because as soon as the person internalizes it about themselves, the job is way harder because you've got to get through that first. That's a different wall altogether.
Right. And I think in the workplace, it's sometimes pretty clear to make that separation. But at the same time, my boss is a good person, but he's a real asshole in the workplace. And so it makes for tough times, even though we play tennis on Sundays and have strawberries after. So when that's the yes. situation, and we clearly have a separation from the great person away from the building, and then inside that dynamic, how do we sort of attack that angle if we already passed step one?
Oh, I mean, that's where the educative side comes in. That if you educate everybody about what trauma is and what it isn't, how it plays out, then people get a sense of what they're seeing. Because it's very easy in an organization, like you said, even with a family or in a relationship, or you're the asshole, I'm not, right? I don't know what's going on with me. I see you behaving like that. That looks like misbehavior to me. So I'm going to blame you. I'm going to throw this hot potato at you, whereas I'm all right. So that's the natural inclination in groups until you're really self-aware that you own it. And then, or you go to somebody and go, you just don't seem like yourself. What's going on? Right? We don't tend to do that. But if you educate everybody around what they're likely to see in terms of what trauma is, then they're talking the same language in a way. They're like, oh, okay, so you're overwhelmed, you're full. You're not really an arsehole, so what can we do? What do we need to tweak to help you? So again, it all works together. It's like that fairground ride, that it's moving, all the parts are moving and they don't bang into each other, but they get to understand, okay, this is how it works.
That would seem to be difficult at times with people in leadership positions, because part of that track as you rise through the ranks is you're going to get a personality type who's, driven, terribly competitive, and all these dynamics that sometimes counter the ability to be self-reflective and open to feedback and things like that, especially from people that they're managing, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but they're the people that burn out, right? So everybody has a limit. They just don't believe they have. Yeah. So, but what you do for people like this is that you appeal to their intellect to help them start interpreting, using their intellect to interpret what's going on in the body. And one of the things people in leadership need to understand is that they affect people. People do what they see and what they feel, not what you say. So again, that comes down to that contagion. And somebody who is driven and perhaps distraught with their level of drive and they're in disarray, that affects the people next to them and next to them. And so it can have two ways of impacting. One is an insidious rippling out, which sounds quite gentle, but it's kind of sinister. But you've also got leaders that are in disarray that have massive, brutal impacts on people. Like you said, you know, somebody goes, oh, he's a right arsehole. No, actually, he's in disarray. He doesn't mean to be an arsehole, but he doesn't know how to manage this overwhelm. So it's going to come out as some brutality. And then you've got big, quite nasty impacts, or you have a spat in the office, and then you withdraw from it. So it's there is this kind of slow poisoning of people, and then you've got this kind of brutality. And in fact, the brutality in a way is easier to see, but then people can go, "Oh, you're just an ass." So, yeah. Mm.
So you've been doing this for a long time, and I'm curious whether in recent years, with hyperconnectivity and the boundaries of the workplace being kind of broken down by technology, is burnout and the related things getting worse?
Oh, I couldn't tell you the stats on that, but I can tell you anecdotally what people are saying to me that have properly broken down or been on the verge. That the technology has taken people to a different type of trauma trigger. I've actually worked with people that are triggered just by opening their laptop or seeing email on their phones. So there are some people that are so overwhelmed that I'm like, take that app off your phone. Let's do a live session whilst you open your laptop so that I can try to help you desensitize even seeing the email. So in that sense, your traumatization is right in your living room, right? Or in your bedroom if you've opened your emails there.
Oh, that sounds heavy, Dr. Ann. I've never quite encountered someone at that level who gets a stress response opening their laptop. But you're talking about a physical manifestation of these burnout tendencies because the job is so stressful that picking up and reaching for something, boom, you're in fight or flight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oof. You've nailed it. You've absolutely nailed it. So sometimes. It will deepen from there as well, but it'll just even be the thought of opening it, right? So, right. And that's what trauma does. It changes it, the thinking. And initially, it may have just been a fleeting thought in somebody's mind's eye where they go, oh, I've got those emails I haven't attended to yet, or how many have I got to attend to? And then it starts to become attached to anxiety, breathlessness, panic. So it looks for some people. I know this sounds extreme, but it actually isn't, because this is what happens to the people in burnout and breakdown. The whole system is sensitized to what maybe has contributed to the break in the first place. So if it's the workplace, or sometimes it's even a particular person within a workplace or the building, that's the thing that becomes the trigger. So I've actually worked with people that have got the buildings to trigger. So, okay, right, well, we can work around that, like lots of people are in any case at the moment. They're working from home. Or is there a different place you can go to work that helps reduce that kind of
a different
response?
Entrance, like the celebrity going through the alley and then into the back door instead of the front door, yeah.
Yeah, because really what you have to do in burnout, which is a trauma, type of trauma, in the treatment there, is you try to reduce down the level of agitation and the sensitization so that the person starts over time to feel that they're mastering it and they become in control of it rather than it being in control of them. So that's really what you're doing in terms of post-trauma, is that you're trying to turn the dial down bit by bit so the system's not in trauma.
Yeah, and these extreme examples of someone driving up and seeing the building and freaking out, I think we can relate, we can understand what that's like. But I'm also concerned about when you have this subclinical reaction, and I know I've had that in my own life where I didn't even realize that, you know, the dynamics of my job, workplace, whatever was going on was bringing me down. I still walked around with a smile on my face, and you know, the self-awareness wasn't quite there until I, you know, something struck me where I could sit down in a park and reflect for 10 minutes that, hey, maybe I wasn't even in the right job or something like that. And I mean, that part's probably a whole nother challenge in your career. If you come and meet with someone who's shaking, they're scared to go work with the trauma specialist, Dr. Anna, that's one thing. But those people that are kind of marching along and might even fill out a questionnaire and say, you know, 6 out of 10 for everything, everything's fine, it's okay, it's just fine. But underneath the surface, there's a lot of accumulated stress and trauma. I wonder how you crack that shell.
What I try to help people with is, obviously, if I see an individual and they've come to me for support, then they're already at that stage of awareness. They're like, wow, my life is on the edge and I don't recognize myself. You know, that's they've already got there. If I'm working in an organization, sometimes I come across those people who have changes in thinking that they didn't think were related to overwhelm. So that's really helpful. So I can kind of presume that as a trauma specialist, I presume that one of the things that might happen is that you start to have this gut deep dread of every day. Or I might say, and then people go, oh yeah, I've had that for like 3 months now. Or somebody's joy might go. So that's one of the initial emotions that gets locked off when you're overwhelmed with stress, is that there is little joy in things, even family. And I state that in my in the burnout awareness quiz, because that wakes people up. When they have no joy about being around their own family, they're just like, they feel really altered then. They feel very different. And so that those, if you could get those when they're glimpses or just fleeting thoughts, you're like, oh, right, something's out of kilter here. Am I working too hard? Am I doing what nourishes me? Am I looking after myself? Do I like myself? Is there stuff I need to attend to? If you get those, if you get it at thought stage, you're lucky in a way, right? Which is what prevention education is all about. We don't want people to have to break down for us to take notice and look after them. That's too expensive in so many ways.
Oh gosh, I can imagine. Yeah. It seems like the personal health and self-care piece is pretty huge. And I'm wondering how that element comes into your practice when you're working with the person with the asshole boss that doesn't sleep enough or exercise and eats bad food.
Yeah. Well, I tell them not to give themselves a hard time about that, because they've probably given themselves a good metaphorical kicking already, usually. So the way that I approach that is that you need to be able to be self-aware so that you can self-care. Because quite frankly, by the time I see people that are somewhat breaking down, is that they don't care and they can't. So if I was to say to somebody that's already kind of on their knees and they have no energy, they've got their resources are gone, they're traumatized, and I tell them to go and book a massage, they look at me as if I'm a nutcase. And they're like, where am I going to fit that in? Or I actually can't do it now. So self-care has to be way before this. When we get to somebody that's breaking, we go, right, let's learn about you. Help them be self-aware so that they can actually care enough about themselves to eat well, to exercise some more, pay attention to their sleep. Yeah? Because otherwise what we're asking people is, go, can you go and look after yourself, even though I know you can't? You're asking them to do something they can't do, which only compounds how useless they feel.
Wow, I've never quite heard it put like that. That's very interesting. And we're usually shoving material down people's throats with podcast episodes or books, and don't eat this and don't eat this. But before you crack the pages of the book or even begin to examine all the things that are wrong with your life, yeah, we just got to increase self-awareness.
Exactly. Because sometimes part of the constellation of issues that break somebody down in the first place is that they weren't aware. So it's not their fault, because obviously if you're not aware, you're not aware. But to help somebody to discover all the different elements of themselves, some that they'll like and some that they won't, and that they start to build a more companionable relationship with themselves, they'll never break down in the future, right? Because they won't have they won't expect that of themselves. They won't have to live at their bandwidth consistently. So I'm really careful about self-care techniques before awareness. If somebody's self-aware, you don't need to tell them about a self-care technique. They know, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like going to Zed before you've done the rest of the alphabet. If you go self-care only, you're missing out the element that makes self-care techniques useful, palatable, valuable. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure. I'm wondering, like, what are the most common blind spots when someone is there with missing that self-awareness that's leading to poor self-care and so forth, and burnout and overworking?
You're going to wish you never asked that question.
Oh boy, here we go, people.
My new book is about inner brutality. So inner brutality to self. And so the
what's the title?
Thing,
Inner Brutality by Dr. Anna Pinkerton?
Yet.
Oh, she doesn't have a title.
By the way,
yet.
I'm not a doctor. I'm a psychotherapist. I'm not a doctor.
Okay, well, you call that in the US someone who's super expert.
Well, that's very nice of you. That's very kind.
Sure.
I might borrow that. The biggest thing And I did some research, some kind of anecdotal research on my own diaries last year, and 92.7% of anybody that walked through the door to do work with me in the last few years had high levels of inner brutality, which means they harangue themselves, they berate themselves, they demean themselves in thought and action and diminish themselves. And what I noticed about this was that these people easily fell out with themselves and easily felt that they'd let themselves down. So it meant that in a way that inside themselves, they have divorced. They are not together. They're not integrated. They're not companionable. They're brutal, cruel to themselves. They call themselves the arsehole, the idiot, the whatever, you know, and that it's so pervasive in our society that it's so big, like the pandemic, you almost can't see it. And we've assimilated it as normal. But this is the absolute key to so much illness, to be honest. That's the work that I do with people. We look at what the inner brutality is saying and how you then rewire the brain to build a companionable relationship with self. And then you'll never break down.
Because you'll see these warnings coming. Whoops.
They won't even be there because you're so companionable that you do what is right for you most of the time, obviously with normal life challenges. Yeah.
Right.
So in the same way that I was saying that you don't need to teach somebody self-care if they're companionable to self. They'll just go, oh, I'll have the salad. I won't have the bucket of chicken and chips. Why is that? Oh, because I like myself, or I love myself, even if I don't like everything about myself.
Right. I won't set myself up for a dysfunctional codependent relationship with my asshole boss, because I won't be that person that takes steps down that path, and then it becomes trouble. I love it.
Yeah. What you might do is you might go, oh, look, he's acting like an asshole. He's not an asshole, but he's acting like it. And I'm going to decide I don't want to be around that. I'm going to look after myself and I'm going to walk away.
Yeah. Or, and in my experience, the person who comes off strong-armed in the workplace mostly needs validation and is looking for whatever it is, ego stroking and things like that, where they will be the best version of themselves rather than the worst version. If you don't, you know, counter them with more ammunition, you just kind of, you know, bring out the best in everybody by seeing what they need the most.
Yeah, I mean, that is a reality. I think it's unfortunate. And I think it's misunderstood that actually that's incredibly transparent behavior, right? It's very transparent behavior to somebody who's flipping out around the office and being cross all the time. They're showing their vulnerability, really. But it's not good for the person that's on the end of that, because bullish behavior is bullish behavior and it hurts people. It breaks people down eventually. And it is quite, I think it's quite interesting that that comes across as having a big ego. But actually they don't. They have a very fragile ego, right? So somebody that's got a nice big ego doesn't need to do that because they're looking after themselves.
Give credit to other people, things like that.
Exactly. So they don't, those people with a big, solid, robust ego that is looking after self will look after others, will promote others, will go, you're doing great. But the bullish person, the bullish boss can't do that because they can't do it for themselves yet. Full circle back to the inner brutality, yeah? Once they can do it for themselves, they will never demean or diminish another person. Don't need to.
Jeez, it reminds me of the insights from Dr. Bruce Lipton's book, Biology of Belief, where he references good science that we are 93 to 98% of the time operating from flawed subconscious programming, and these thoughts that are running through our head are 80% of them are identical to yesterday's thoughts. There's tens of thousands of thoughts that we form every single day. And then 80% of those identical thoughts are negative, or 90% are negative. The numbers are staggering that we're just running this tape day after day after day, which is, you know, preponderance of negative, I love that term, inner brutality. So that's the thing that we all have to wake up to. It's like a pandemic.
It really is. It's way, way bigger. It's so, that's what I was saying. It's so big, you can't almost see it. You think it's normal. You think it's normal for somebody to swear and berate themselves, call themselves an idiot, like 100 times a day. You're worthless. You have no value. You're this, you're that. And it isn't necessarily just about negativity. It's about, that's what the operating system is running. And nobody's doing it on purpose, right? We're out of control of what we can't know. If it's subconscious, it can't be, it's nobody's fault. But I think we have to become aware, be prepared to be aware, so that then you gain some control over your operating system, right?
Right.
I didn't want to have an operating system that was telling me I was had no value. So I had to be, oh, okay, I've got to become cognizant of what the wiring is saying, what it's running.
Right, very well said. I think that's nice to distinguish it that way from the extreme examples that we've tossed out, like this self-flagellating talk where I'm such an idiot here, I'm such an idiot there. And I would say I never say that to myself. I'm too smiley and I'm okay and on all these different levels. But underneath the surface of that, I'm doing things that I'm not even aware of that negative bias, and then have to wake up to it later, where it's like, why did I do that? Why did I waste all that time in that interaction that didn't serve me? And all those different examples that are kind of underneath that extreme manifestation of inner brutality. And that part's really interesting, because I think, if it's subconscious, it's not on our minds. We're busy, we're super busy and slammed with an email inbox. We don't have that time to reflect on whether we're, deficient in self-care or self-awareness.
Right. Absolutely. And that's why, that again, it's reasons and not blame, isn't it? Because people, the whole point of being, of something being subconscious is that you're not conscious of it. But what you can see as a clinician, from my point of view, is you can see and hear the brutality. And you can often, in the way that somebody talks and conveys their story, their experience, you get a sense. So I'm quite a visual person inside here, and I can go, oh, I can see the constellation of this brutality, how it holds somebody down or how it's now wreaking havoc with them. And then what you do is you go, right, this is how the brutality is playing out. And this is the same in teams, by the way. This is absolutely the center to why teams are having issues, because one person has an extremely high level of inner brutality, projects it out onto somebody else. That person has inner brutality. They think it's them. I'm not managing him very well. And so nobody's really talking about the wiring, of course. Who does? Except people like me. take the people away from it and say, oh, this is what one person's wiring is doing to another person, and it's creating an absolute nightmare in this organization. Oh, okay, let's look at it as though it's wiring it, and let's rewire it then.
And how does one begin that process of rewiring?
It's about making a decision. I call it the vow, taking a vow towards self, where you become committed and utterly dedicated to building a companionable relationship with self. So more than compassion. So compassion is passive. Companionability is active and dynamic. So I can have compassion to somebody on the other side of the world and go, oh, I'm really sorry they're going through that. And that's passive. I can't be a companion to them. So companionability to self is really active, where you get alongside yourself and you're encouraging and supportive, and you do not demean and diminish yourself. You do not swear and berate yourself. What you do is you go, oh, that's interesting that I did that. I wonder why I did such a thing. So you become inquisitive and curious around what you do and feel, rather than critical, which just closes you down again.
The observer of your thoughts and your actions. The silent observer, as they say.
Yeah, it's like you. What I call it is like you look at self with a wide-angle lens. Be prepared to see what's inside. But put the companionability in first, because if you don't like what you find inside here, you're going to fall out with yourself. So you've got to go, okay, I might not be keen on that. But because I'm practicing companionability to self, I'm prepared to see, do I want to live with that or not? And once you're more self-aware, you get to choose. You know, you get to choose. Whereas if it's not conscious to you, you're at the mercy of the wiring completely. That makes sense.
Right. I imagine there's a blank piece of paper and all of a sudden it's getting filled in with all these insights that we finally are taking the time and making that commitment to self to put them down there. I mean, is that actually how your process might go, including written exercises, or I guess if you're working one-on-one with the client, they're unloading some storage off of the hard drive.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And I do use that, you know, I do use visuals. I do use pictures. I'm an art psychotherapist for a start. So I tend to, and that's how I see it. So it's about, and one of them is really simple. Just put a circle on a blank sheet. What do you want in your inner circle and what do you want to move for the outside? So you can do that in terms of your wiring. Do I always want to be kindly to others? Yes, I do. I'll have that in my inner circle then. Do I want to stop shouting at people?
Not necessarily.
It depends what you want. You know, you get to choose, but you can't choose if you're not self-aware. But the companionability has to be there as your guide, if you like, the thing that sustains you and helps you navigate that self-awareness journey. Because if you go in with the brutality and you start looking at what's inside, you're going to fall out with yourself, or you're going to feel like you've let yourself down. And those are the two things that we're trying to get away from. So we'll always make mistakes, but if we meet the mistake with a companionability, we just go, okay, I don't feel so good about that. How am I going to do differently next time? Move through it. Whereas with inner brutality, what we do is go, I made a mistake. I can't forgive myself. I'm going to feel guilty for the rest of my life. I'm going to stick. And you carry that for life. And then everything becomes heavy.
You carry that into anything you do.
Absolutely.
Right.
That becomes part of your MO.
So even that simple exercise of drawing the circle and then the stuff outside of the circle, and I guess you're going to, I mean, everything's in the circle when you start, and so then you're going to make a distinction, and the stuff outside of the circle is patterns that you identify or traits or whatever it is. I spend late nights answering email and getting frustrated, and I do that all the time, so I'm going to put that outside of the circle and say that I'm going to flip the lid closed as soon as I feel stressed when I'm catching up on email or things like that, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's a deep formula that's going with that, you see, because a lot of people think that their value is based on what they do. So they may inadvertently open the laptop at 10:30 at night, let's say, because they think they're a more valuable human being if they do that. So the companionability to self means that you have value whether you're sat on the sofa staring forward doing nothing or whether you're running a multi-million pound charity. You have to be a valuable human being no matter what. It can't be contingent on anything. It can't be based on anything. Otherwise, you've given your value over to something outside of you, and then you're not doing the job of looking after self. That makes sense.
Oh, makes sense to about 99.5% of us. I don't know about over on your side of the pond, but I think that's the story of modern life, and we're all trying to extricate from that with varying levels of success and continued, you know, daily growth and getting up again and trying to, you know, build that inner self-respect so that we can release attachment to the outcome of what we're doing. And it's pretty difficult because the world's teed up to measure and judge us, huh?
Well, we can't do it if we've got inner brutality there. Because inner brutality is either there or you're either your own worst enemy or you're your own best friend. And there isn't a middle ground there.
And
I mean, this is challenging work, right?
Challenging. What percentage of your people that you've engaged with are starting with that inner brutality?
92.7%.
Right.
So
that's crazy.
And actually, to be honest with you, it's very rare that you'll find a human being without it, because it's so normalized that people have fallen out with themselves, particularly in the UK. Although, you know, it's a big thing to demean oneself and to talk in a derogatory manner towards oneself. And I don't think we truly are cognizant of the impact of that on life and how that is really creating sadness and distress for the human being. It's just so big. But that's what my challenge is to write a book and a manual so that I can train people in this methodology, because it works. And somebody could come to me with trauma, imposter syndrome, poor self-esteem, self-sabotage, and doing the companionability work deals with all of it. All of it.
Sure. They're going to leverage everything.
So that's, for me, that now this is like over thousands of hours of work. It's coming to, let me put the work and my energy into what's really going to help, where the core work is. And it is about turning the dial down on the brutality and till you can switch it off, and then turn the dial up on the companionability so that that becomes the new normal. Because we're born like that, in fact. We're not born hating ourselves.
Right. Yeah, we get programmed from ages 0 to 7, according to Dr. Lipton and others in that research. And whenever we first get criticized for doing something that didn't work out, and then we start to internalize everything. And then pretty soon we form these rigid beliefs, and they're very hard to extricate from.
Absolutely. But they're not impossible. And that's the key. That it's difficult. But once it's done, once you've done the rewiring, the brain goes, oh, I'll give up on that shitty old default position of brutality then. This is way better. But you've got to convince the brain to let it go. So it tips over to, oh, I'll be companionable forever. That means I'm quiet inside. That means I live with ease. That means I live with contentment in a way that I never have. So you've got to convince the brain. Yeah, it's tricky. It's a wrestling match for a while.
And how do you facilitate that exercise?
You have patience. So what I do is I help people understand what the circuitry is saying. Again, it's not you. This was programmed in. This is the program that's running. Does it suit you? Yes, no. Oh, no. Okay, right. It doesn't suit you anymore. Right. It doesn't serve you at all. You check out how it does serve, if so. And then you go, right, what doesn't? What needs rewiring here? And then you just, over time in conversation with the person, you look at what the core beliefs are. Are they true? Do they make sense? Do they serve you? Change the core belief. And then the brain's going, really? You can change these things that seem totally immovable? And so you're teaching the brain that actually you've got this plasticity, right? You can move it. You can mold it. See, this is why I sometimes say to people, it's not mindset. This is not mindset. It's jelly. It's very wibbly wobbly. I mean, you have to persevere to change the look of it, to make it go, oh, okay. It's prepared to give it up for the better.
So for the listener, is there some takeaway exercise we can implement? I imagine spending a few minutes every day with a journal and looking at the facts versus the beliefs, or something where we can build some momentum to do this this progress from inner brutality toward companionability. Companionability? Did you make that word up, Anna?
Yeah, see, that's No, it's the true word.
Oh, okay.
But I've had lots and lots of practice saying it. So, but I do think for the book, I'm going to have to find something that is a little bit easier to say.
Oh, no, I like it. I assumed you made it up and I thought that was pure genius. So we're just going to go with that.
Okay, well, I'll take it.
Companionability.
Why not? Companionability to self, yeah. I for me, I think one of the most useful things is to train oneself to notice and be curious without judgment, which is really hard. So that's why I'm using the word train, to kind of relearn the curiosity of, oh gosh, what is it interesting that I swear at myself, or I feel about this part of my life or this part of my personality or temperament, I feel actually really bad about myself. Like, that curiosity is really, really helpful, because it's more of a floaty, I'm prepared to have a look. So it doesn't scare the brain, because if you go too hard on it, the brain's going to go, oh, I bloody love my old default. I love my brutality. I love it.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
So the brain loves what it knows, and it will keep going because it bloody loves what it knows. So be curious, and you kind of trick the brain then, go, oh, yeah. So I noticed that I swear at myself when I drop something in the kitchen. All you've done is drop something in the kitchen, and we all do that. So why am I demeaning myself, calling myself names about a simple little accident? So it's, you know, you could do that all through your days, you know, or just do it for half an hour and go, oh, okay. Oh, gosh, I do diminish myself. I make myself very small inside and very vulnerable. I'm really mean in the way I talk. Yeah. If you say, start getting a sense of what that constellation of words are, maybe the atmosphere within.
Right. Every time we're in the conference room at a meeting and someone interrupts me, I get fired up inside and I'm furious. Oh, gee. I wonder where that comes from, and maybe it's my past programming or something that I can look at rather than just see who interrupted me today.
Exactly. And being able to zoom in on what the distress is that causes and what's that attached to, because it will always be attached to something. And again, without judgment, you go, oh, that's really interesting. That's because when I was 8 years old, that happened. Boom. That's all you need to know.
Mm.
It's there for a reason. Right. It's just that the reasons and the programming is way out of date now. And that's why it's causing suffering now. It's just out of date. And so that's why the companionability training is so important, because the distress in the human being and the brutality just gets worse and worse through life.
Mm.
Partly because the brain just loves it because it loves its habits. But also because it gets more and more out of date. Like you said, if it was programmed in by the age of 7 or 8, but you're now like 58, it's way out of date. Doesn't serve you anymore.
When an adult acts like a child, especially in the workplace, it's like, come on, this is ridiculous. It's so obvious. Yeah.
Whereas what I say to them, it's a shame that you feel that way. What can we do to help? So you meet them where they're at. You go, okay, that must be really hard for you to keep acting like an ass, because you're not getting back what you want, really.
Yeah. Wow. I could see how if this this technology was injected into a team environment, you could have incredible transformation.
Indeed. Absolutely. I mean, if companies and organizations would educate themselves around inner brutality, and how that becomes outer brutality, because that's what happens. All brutality is made within, but the exact opposite is also true. So people that are companionable to themselves are kindly and compassionate and companionable to others, because they do not need to demean another human being to make themselves feel better.
Mm.
Right? It's massive.
Sure. Right. Love it, Anna. What a great message. I'm really inspired, and I think we can go to your website and take a quiz you mentioned.
Yeah, on my website, which is just annapinkerton.com, there's a resources page. It's got the burnout prevention quiz, which is the really early warning signs in terms of changing in thinking. That's really helpful in terms of, right, things that you might not think are helping you head towards burnout. There's an infographic on there as well, which tells you bits about how it manifests in physically as well. There's all kinds of bits and bobs on there.
Okay, we're going to go visit annapinkerton.com. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Great show. Yeah. Enough of the inner brutality, people. Let's progress toward companionability with self.
There you go.
Da, 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 da. Thank you for listening to the show. We would love your feedback at getoveryourselfpodcast@gmail.com. And we would also love if you could leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a hassle. You have to go to desktop iTunes, click on the tab that says ratings and reviews, and then click to rate the show anywhere from 5 to 5 stars. And it really helps spread the word so more people can find the show and get over themselves because they need to. Thanks for doing it.